Andrew's observations are certainly correct. His information is more accurate and thorough than mine about the reputation of the Book of Job. Open your notes, if you would, as well as the Book of Job at chapter 1. I think, in fact, the Book of Job is, if not unique, unusual at the very least in the many, many books that make up the Bible, the 66 books that make up the Bible. I think in terms of its reputation, as simply in terms of its reputation as a magnificent piece of literature, it is extraordinary. Here's the quote from Thomas Carlyle, all right? We'll get it absolutely right this time. I've got it quoted like this, that he said of the Book of Job that it is one of the grandest things ever written with pen. There is nothing written, I think, in the Bible or out of it of equal literary merit. It's an extraordinary book, and a book that has had powerful impact on thinkers of various kinds, and thinkers thinking about various problems. Thinkers not just Christian, but philosophers of various kinds have looked to the Book of Job. There's been a play written, at least one play, I'm sure there have been others written, based on the Book of Job, another reinterpretation of the message of the Book of Job. It is a book that has had really quite an enormous impact, at least on thinking in Western civilization over the last thousands of years. And it stands out as an unusual book. I wouldn't say that about the Book of Esther that goes before it. I don't think I'd even say it about the Psalms that follow it. Or there aren't very many books, particularly within the Old Testament, that have had such an influence as the Book of Job. But I actually don't think that's very important. So in fact, the Book of Job comes to us, we find it here, in the pages of the Bible. The book which we know and understand to be the Word of God to us. And so, rather more important than admiring the beauty of the book, and I think as we read through the book we'll see something of that, its beauty and its grandeur, it is that, nor simply being aghast at the profundity of its thought. It is a profound book and it explores profound problems, but we really need to come to grips with and grapple with understanding its message. We need to understand what the book is saying, not just how beautiful it is. Find and admire how beautiful it is, but what is it saying? What is it about? So you know that when you come to understand what a book of the Bible is about, or a passage in the Bible is about, what it is saying, you actually come to understand what God himself is saying. Now that's what our approach, I hope, will be to the Book of Job. Now, having said that, we want to understand what the book is saying, what the book's about, that's easier said than done. Sometimes you actually have to dig for treasure, and sometimes you have to do some hard work before you discover it and find it. But the Book of Job is a book whose message is not immediately obvious. And we're going to have to do a lot of thinking and hard thinking, it seems to me, if we're going to understand the message that this book has for us. For the Book of Job is not simply about why do the innocent suffer. Oh, that problem. Life throws up that problem. Whenever anybody is suffering, and whether you think they're innocent or not, but you don't think they deserve the suffering they're getting, there's a great moral problem there, isn't there? It's especially a moral problem if you believe in God. Come on in. Join us. You're welcome. I'm saying that the most important thing for us is to understand what the book is about. The first thing that most people think the Book of Job is about, the problem of suffering, the so-called problem of suffering. The problem of suffering is certainly there. There's a lot of suffering in the book, and whenever you see suffering, there's a problem. Especially if you see suffering that you're profoundly aware, you can't help but feel in your bones, that the person who's suffering doesn't deserve the suffering they're getting. At least they don't deserve it any more than somebody else over here who's not getting it. Suffering in this world is distributed in a most uneven way. And that immediately raises problems for us whenever we see it. There's a deep problem there, and many people grapple and think about the problem of suffering. Why is there suffering, and if there is suffering, why is it distributed so unevenly and apparently so unfairly through the world? And if God is there ruling over the world, it gives you another problem. Is God really just and righteous if he's ruling over the world and suffering is going on like that? Now, that's a problem. It's a problem that's present in the Book of Job because Job suffers, and one thing that's perfectly obvious from what we'll see tonight, Job doesn't deserve the suffering he gets. Okay? He doesn't deserve it. Mightn't describe him as exactly innocent. We'll see why that in a minute. But he doesn't deserve the suffering he gets, it seems. in this book. And so the problem is there, but the book is actually about a deeper problem than that, as we'll see. A more fundamental problem, a more basic problem of life than simply the problem of suffering. And I hope that we'll get to see at least the beginning of what that problem is today. We're looking tonight at really the first two chapters, which set up the situation for us in the book. You notice there are lots of books of the Bible like this, where the books themselves are fairly hard books, and I don't know, how many people here have read, just very quickly so nobody knows who it is, who's read Job from cover to cover? Put them down again quickly so anyone sees who didn't put their hand up. It's a book that not that many people have read from cover to cover. It's fairly hard going, isn't it? At least in the middle. There's a few books in the Bible like that, but have you noticed that a lot of them have an easy bit at the beginning? Like the book of Revelation. Everybody's familiar with the letters to the seven churches, and then you stop there because it gets a bit hard after that. The book of Daniel, well, the first six chapters are these, the fiery furnace and all those stories. Everyone knows those stories, and they're fairly straightforward. Then you stop at chapter 7 because it gets difficult after that. Job's a bit like that. The first two chapters are fairly familiar to us, and the story at least is fairly straightforward. After that, it gets difficult. So come back next week. It'll be difficult next week. But today we're looking at the first two chapters where really the situation is set up for us. The main problem that the book's going to be about is introduced, and we meet the main characters. Okay, so we'll follow through the... Well, there are six scenes. We're only going to look at five scenes, and we'll leave the very last scene in chapter 2 till next week. Let's all have something easy to talk about next week. The first scene sets the stage for us. And look with me, will you, at the first five verses. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had seven sons and three daughters, and 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and a large number of servants. You'd need them, wouldn't you? He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they'd invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he'd sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. First off, let's see where it's all happening. It's happening in the land of Uz. Anyone know where the land of Uz is? No, nor do I. Okay? It's in the east, yes, that's not bad. Yeah, you're right. It's in the east. Good. Anyone more specific than that? Anyone been to the land of Uz? I don't know where the land of Uz is. I don't think anyone knows where the land of Uz is. Yeah, I think that perhaps this set, for a reason that I'll spell out in a moment as well, I think that the land of Uz, the setting of the book, is deliberately vague. It's in the east, as Jim rightly says, for we gather that from verse 3, that it's somewhere in the east. I mean, that would be the east from the land of Israel, over to the east, perhaps in the area of Babylon, something like that. But it's a faraway country. The land of Uz, outside the confines of Israel. Now, that's unusual in the Old Testament. Most books in the Old Testament take place within Israel and the people of God in Israel. This book is outside of Israel, and I think that that is the first hint that the issues that this book is going to deal with, the issues of life that are dealt with here, are more widely applicable than simply to the people of Israel in the Old Testament. There's something very fundamental about life that is being dealt with in this book. It's a book that deals with things that are true of a man whose name is Job, who lives in the land of Uz, not in the land of Israel. Well, that's the central character. We meet him, the man whose name is Job. We meet him in verse 1. He does not seem to be a Jew, or a Hebrew, or an Israelite, however you like to describe him. He's one, as verse 3 tells us again, he's one of the people of the East. But much more important than all that information is what we learn about him in verse 1, the second half of verse 1, that he was blameless and upright, he feared God and shunned evil. Now there, the first verse of the book is a key statement. Want to understand what this book is about? Understand this much about Job to start with. He was a man of extraordinary godliness. He was a man who believed in God and trusted in God, loved God, and lived a life that showed it. Indeed, this man, Job, was a model of godliness. Doesn't actually mean he was sinless, mind you. Doesn't mean he never did anything wrong, ever, ever, ever. Doesn't mean he was perfect. That's not what's being said here. You see, Job, later on in the book, Job will talk about his own sins. He acknowledges that he is a sinner, acknowledges that. But the point is, his sins are dealt with. The point is, he is a person who acknowledges his sins, acknowledges that before God, and that's dealt with. He takes sin seriously. You can see that in the second paragraph that I read to you. Certainly he takes the possibility of his children having sinned seriously. And in the ways that belonged to those days, he went about making sure that those sins were dealt with, that that guilt was dealt with. And he can rightly be described as a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. He's a model of what a godly person ought to be. Now bear that in mind. So that's the first important thing about Job. The second thing is that he is quite clearly very prosperous in every sense of the word in the ancient world. I don't know how you'd characterize a typically prosperous person in the modern world, but this guy is a typically prosperous person in the ancient world, very prosperous person, with all those goats and animals and all those sort of things, and the servants. Even the fact that he's got 7 sons and 3 daughters doesn't seem to be a bad thing in this context. It seems to be a good thing. Right? Nice, large family, happy family life, where they have their parties from home to home, and everything seems to be a rosy, idyllic, virtually. Idyllic conditions. A description of life at its very best. The good life being lived by this man, Job, in the land of Uz. Happy, prosperous family life, and all that you could hope for. Now, there he is. He is a model of godliness, and he is also prosperous. And no connection is actually made between those two things in the text at this point, but I can't help feeling that there is an appropriateness about it. What you've got is a man here who has been clearly blessed by God in a whole range of ways. And you can't help but feel it's appropriate that such a man should be blessed by God. In the Old Testament, particularly in the Psalms, the people who wrote the Psalms often had a great problem, and the problem was that you could look at people who are ungodly, who hate God, who curse God, who have nothing to do with God, and they're thriving. And they get a problem with that. Why should God keep giving good things to all those people who hate him? Why should the wicked prosper, and you look at another godly person over here who's following God and serving God, and he's suffering in various ways? That's a problem. But this isn't a problem. That problem isn't here. This man, Job, is prosperous. He's blessed by God. God has given him many, many things and given him great happiness in life. And it seems perfectly appropriate that that should be so. He's the sort of man that it seems appropriate that God should so bless him. Okay, well, that's Job. We meet him there. The action of the book begins in the second scene. And we're taken in a strange way behind the scenes of life. And we're given a glimpse into heaven and something that happens in heaven. And heaven is presented to us here as a sort of heavenly royal court, which is assembled. You get a scene like that in a couple of other places in the Old Testament. They've given 2 references you might like to chase up later on in your own time. A heavenly court. God, the great King of heaven, seated on his throne, and all his servants are assembled before him to receive their orders, to report the things they've been doing in God's service. That's the picture of heaven that we have here. They're called angels, literally sons of God they are in the Hebrew, but it's a word that refers to all of God's heavenly servants, God the great King with all his servants before him. Well, let us see what happens there in heaven. One day the angels, or the sons of God, came to present themselves before the Lord. There they are assembled before the heavenly throne in the heavenly courtroom. And Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Satan replied, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and his herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he'll be sure to curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, take everything he has, so everything he has is in your hands. But on the man himself, don't lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. The first strange thing we see in this heavenly scene, this scene of heaven as a royal courtroom, The first strange thing is that Satan is there. Now, we know quite a bit about Satan. If you have read beyond the book of Job in the Bible, especially if you've read into the New Testament, you know quite a lot about Satan that wouldn't have been known to the first readers of this particular book. There's not a great deal said about Satan in the Old Testament, but here he is. In fact, here he's called the Satan. Satan isn't his name. He's called the Satan, and the word Satan means accuser. Now, we ask the question, we know it's all very well, it's fine for us to know more about him, but what that causes us to ask is why is he there? This is heaven. This is all God's servants in front of him. What's Satan doing there? But of course Satan is there. But don't forget that Satan, the devil, is a servant of God. An unwilling servant, a rebellious servant, but nonetheless it is one who's unable to lift a finger without God's permission. And he's answerable to God for everything that he does. So Satan is here in this heavenly court. What does he do? What's his job? Well, in verse 7, we're told that he roams through the earth, going to and fro in it. I think that he probably is something like, in this scene, he's something like a spy for the king. That's the analogy that I think has been drawn here, who roams over the kingdom, roams through the kingdom of the great king, reporting back to the king on any evil that he happens to find, any rebellion that he might find throughout the realm. And that's what Satan's job is, something like that. And the trouble with Satan, of course, is he takes it upon himself to actually provoke evil. If he can't find any, to make sure there's something to report back. But that seems to be his job. Now, God asks Satan the crucial question in verse 8, you see? God says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Why does God ask Satan that question? Perhaps God is saying, "Have you been doing your job properly? You so enjoy coming back and reporting evil to me. You haven't told me anything about Job. You haven't reported the fact that you've seen Job and reported the fact that here is true godliness. That doesn't seem to be the sort of thing you enjoy reporting. Perhaps there is here, and I think there is, something of a challenge that God is issuing to Satan, as we'll see it falls out in a moment. God is challenging the Satan, and he knows that the Satan is actually opposed to God's own purposes, and God is here challenging Satan. But it's a remarkable thing that with Job, God seems to be confident that he's going to win a victory over Satan. He's going to prove that Satan is wrong. He's going to do it with Job. Well, the Satan's response brings us to a major theme of the book of Job, verses 9 and 10. What does he say? Does Job fear God for nothing? Here's the question. Haven't you put a hedge around him and his household and everything that he has? Of course he fears you. Of course he loves you. Of course he trusts you. Look at all the things you've given him. You've bribed him into it. Now think about the question. When he says, does Job fear God for nothing? To fear God in the Old Testament is a word for trusting God, an expression for trusting God. It doesn't mean terror, shivering in your boots. There is certainly an appropriate way in which many ought to shiver before God. But those who know God in the Old Testament fear God. They reverence him, they regard him, but they trust him. And they obey him and love him. And that expression, that whole attitude is summed up in the expression to fear the Lord, to fear God. Now, what Satan is saying, does Job fear God for nothing? Isn't he in it for what he can get out of it? Now, what he is saying is that Job's godliness, for all his superficial appearance, isn't really good at all. It's purely selfishness. He's saying faith in God, people who trust in God, aren't the noble creatures that they make themselves out to be. They're actually self-centered people. They're in it for what they can get out of it. Job doesn't simply trust in God. He trusts in God because he knows that all the benefits that he gets from that. Now, this is the first great question of the book, and I want to try and work hard and ask you to work just as hard, or even harder, to see how it's an important question. An important question for us. So the question is there such a thing as faith in God which is more than or other than simply self-interest? is your faith in God, is it open to the accusation that it really is just selfishness? Now, you're just in it for what you can get out of it, aren't you? Don't you trust in God because you expect God to be good to you? That's the sort of question that Satan is asking. Oh, yes, there's this group of people, they trust in God, but really, they're simply in it for what they can get out of it. Haven't you heard people say, try this line, look, why don't you become a Christian? Why don't you be a Christian? Because if we're right, you've got nothing to lose. And if we're wrong, sorry, if we're right, you've won everything. And if we're wrong, you won't lose anything. You know that sort of line? We've got that round the right way, but something like that. Okay, so well, you might as well become a Christian, because if Christianity is right, then certainly it's pretty important to be a Christian, because of what you'll get out of it. If Christianity is wrong, then you won't have lost anything, because it won't matter in the end, will it? Or you've heard people say, no, I won't become a Christian now, because on my deathbed I can do it. I can put my trust in God when I'm dying. I can turn to God then. That'll do, won't it? I'll get out of God what I want to get out of God then. Can't I do it at the last minute? Now, those examples start to point us to the fact that faith in God is open to the accusation or open to the challenge, but it's simply selfishness. But I want us to think about our faith in God. Is your faith in God simply selfishness? Can Satan say before God, point to you and say, does X fear God for nothing? He's in it for what he can get out of it. Now, is that true or isn't it? I want you to think about it. Because that's the question this book is beginning to answer. Satan is accusing God of bribing people into trusting him. That's the question that's raised. Is God actually moral in the end? God himself moral? Isn't God actually bribing people into trusting him? And so people trusting God are actually still thoroughly self-centered people, and that's why they do it. Okay, that's the question. It's an important question, you might understand. It's actually fundamental to the whole of what God is doing in the world. It's a challenge to the goodness, the very goodness of God's ways with the world. It's a challenge to the heart of the Christian gospel. Is the gospel a good thing? Are we going around actually getting people to believe in God, but actually we're only encouraging their selfishness? Because we want them to believe in God so they won't go to hell. Is that all there is to it? Okay, see the problem. Well, the problem's an important one. At least God regards it as an important one, because he actually responds amazingly to Satan's charge. I mean, God could simply say to Satan, pull your head in, who do you think you are challenging me? I know what I'm doing and I do what's right. He could do that, but he doesn't in this case. In verse 11, Satan proposes a test to see whether he's right or not. And he suggests that God should stretch out his hand and strike everything that Job has, and then says, Satan, Job will curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, very well, everything that he has is in your hands, only on the man himself you must not lay a finger. So you might immediately ask why. Why does God accept the Satan's challenge? And the writer doesn't explain that to us, and I can't suggest an answer to the question. On the one hand, we can see that God does, in fact, put Job to this test. It is God's will to demonstrate that there is such a thing as faith in God, which is not mere selfishness. God's going to demonstrate that. He's going to demonstrate what that's like in a moment, as we read on. It's really impossible for us to ask beyond that why God is doing it. On the other hand, we can say it is an extraordinary thing that God is confident. We want to see before we finish tonight why God can be so confident that there is such a thing as good godliness. There is such a thing as faith in God, which is not just self-interest. Now, how can God be confident that there's such a thing? We'll see that before we get to the end. Well, that takes us to scene three. And our attention is taken back onto the earth. In fact, we're taken back to that happy situation in scene one, where there is Job and his prosperous, happy family. Their swimming pools and their colour tellies and their video recorders and their computers, what else have they got? Porsches. You know, all the things that make up the good life in the ancient world are there. And we notice, it can't help but notice, in scene three, that all of that, blow by blow, is drastically destroyed. Listen to it from verse 13 of chapter 1. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at their oldest brother's house, here we are, that happy scene, how it starts. A messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were ploughing and the donkeys, you remember how many of them there were, mind you, the oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby when the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came in and said, the fire of God, lightning, I think, the fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. Quite a day. While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at their eldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept across the desert and struck the four corners of the house, and it collapsed on them, and they're dead. And I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. Blow after blow. Everything that made up Job's prosperous life is destroyed. Each blow more devastating than the one before. Job, of course, doesn't know what we know from seeing that second scene, the things that happened in heaven, but no idea of that. There is nothing in this that's in itself sort of supernatural. All these disasters are so-called natural disasters. We're the only ones that know of the hand of God or the hand of Satan behind them. Job simply suffers an extraordinary series of calamities, one after another. Now listen, as we hear of Job's response. At this, Job got up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. They're ancient expressions of mourning and woe. Do you notice, first of all, that there is no stoicism here. There is no stiff upper lip. The Job that we're going to see is not a man who is able to, simply by the strength of his character, to bear such crushing burdens. This is tragedy. And it is tragedy. And it strikes him as tragedy. And he's thrown into grief and mourning. Now, you and I might be able to sit back, at least for the first couple of these disasters, and sit back in a distant sort of armchair way if you've never suffered it, and say, well, they were only sins, weren't they? You might say that of the servants. I'm not sure whether you say that of the servants. That he lost his property. But have you ever seen the face of anyone? It's always most offensive thing to me when these situations are photographed on television and broadcast. Nevertheless, we've all seen it, I think. Somebody whose house has burnt down. No one's been killed or anything, but all of their possessions are gone. Now, I think that's a tragedy. You can see it on a person's face. Job takes this as a tragedy. It's a tragedy to him. And he's broken by it. And he mourns, he grieves. Not to mention the fact, of course, that he's lost his family as well. All his children. Dead. Yes, he grieves. This is not about stoicism. It's not going to be about stoicism at any point in this book. Stoicism has got nothing to do with the Bible. Stiff upper lip has nothing to do with being godly. Pretending that tragedy is not tragedy is nothing to do with the Bible. Tragedy is tragedy, and it breaks people's hearts. And people cry at tragedy. And there's nothing noble about not crying when you're faced with tragedy. For tragedy is tragedy. And so Job got up, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground in despair. No, it doesn't say that. You would have expected it to say that, didn't you? He fell to the ground, you see? In worship. And, verse 21, he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. The striking thing about Job's response is not that he's a stoic and untouched by the tragedy, but first, that in the midst of a tragedy, in the midst of enormous suffering, He sees God's hand in it. Now, that is not easy. He doesn't think, as we might even think, having read the whole story, he doesn't think, oh, this is some evil force, but God is good. No, God's in it. And if God rules over the world, then when you suffer, God is in it. Can't avoid it, can you? No good having some sort of idea that God's too weak to overcome. God lets it happen, but he doesn't really want it to happen. In some way, God's in it. If God rules over the world at every point, and God's in control, and God is God, and you or I suffer, and tragedy strikes, God's in it. But beyond that, what we see in Job is a contentment, extraordinary contentment, but a contentment in the fact that God is God, and by implication, God is good. He's not just reading his teaching, you know. It is because of what he knows of God that he is able in this situation of extraordinary tragedy to be content in a, not content in a way that doesn't mean his heart is broken, not content in a way that he doesn't weep, but content in a way that he can still turn and put his trust in God, because God is God and that is good. Well, Satan's first test has failed. Very quickly, let's look at the other test. What happens then? Because we're taken back to heaven to see what happens. And in the fourth scene, scene four, we see a fairly familiar now sequence of events. Chapter 2, verse 1. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came with them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" It's familiar, isn't it? Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him, or there is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Nothing has changed. He still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him without reason." But Satan's retort, this time, is even more savage than before. Verse 4, he says, "Skin for skin. A man will give all he has for his own life. Job is such a cynical fellow," says the Satan, "that he's prepared to watch others suffer and die, but he continues to have faith in God as long as you don't touch him. As long as he thinks that he'll save his own neck, as long as he thinks he'll get to heaven, so to speak, he really couldn't give a damn about the rest. He's simply a hard-hearted, totally selfish person." Says Satan, "Faith in God couldn't be more selfish," says Satan. "It's so selfish that he continues to have faith in God when that sort of tragedy surrounds him. He couldn't give a damn about the world around him. Not even his own family. There he is believing in God. Total selfish," says the Satan. Well, as you know, a second test is proposed. The Satan says in verse 5, "Stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and his bones, and then he'll curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Very well, he's in your hands, but you must spare his life." And we turn then to the fifth scene, the last scene we're looking at tonight, and you know the Satan strike. Verse 7, "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head." I don't know what the disease was, but a dreadful disease it was. "And then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes." He's actually on the dunghill outside the town, where the dung from the town and the other rubbish is tipped and the outcasts are sent. Job's suffering has not only his personal suffering, but he's now estranged from his community. And his wife comes up with a word of helpful advice. Verse 9. "Are you still holding on to your integrity?" she says. "Curse God and die." There are those who suggest that in the first test, Satan was smart enough to spare Job's wife because he knew that in her he had an ally. But see the subtle form in which Satan's temptation comes. Here is a man, and I don't know if there has ever been a man who has suffered like this man is suffering. He is suffering personally, physically. He is suffering socially in every way that you can suffer socially. That is, no one's talking to him. He's kicked out of the town. He has lost everything he has ever possessed and every relationship he's ever enjoyed. He is suffering as no one has ever suffered before, I suggest to you. Deep, deep suffering. And in the midst of his suffering, Satan is saying to him, through his wife in this particular case, what Satan says to us all whenever we suffer. I know whether you've suffered much. I suspect that many of us haven't really suffered, but some of us will have suffered. You know what suffering is. You know what tragedy is. You know what happens. You know what Satan says to you when you're suffering. He shouts at you in suffering. And he says, God does not care. And if you haven't experienced it in your own life, haven't you experienced it in witnessing the suffering of others, seeing the suffering of others? Don't you hear the voice of Satan crying at you, God doesn't care? Isn't that what suffering says to us? Suffering and loss? When nothing goes right? When everything starts to fall apart? Don't you hear the voice of Satan saying, God doesn't care? That's what happens in the midst of suffering. Well, what happens? How does Job respond? Verse 10, he replied, you're talking like a fool. You're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? And in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Job continued to trust God. Job continued to place his faith in God. Satan had said, Job fears God for what he can get out of it. He is now getting nothing out of it. Absolutely nothing, not in his experience. Let me remind you that in the Old Testament at this particular point things will change as the book unfolds, but I don't think that Job actually knows anything about the afterlife or life after death. I don't think he does at this point know anything about life after death. If he does, it's only a very vague glimmer, nothing like the promises of the New Testament. He doesn't know anything about that. And here he is suffering without any hope like that everything will be all right in heaven. He hasn't got that in mind, but he simply is trusting God in the midst of suffering. Now, how does it happen? We're going to think about the conclusion. How can it be that a man in that sort of suffering who recognises that he's lost everything, and he recognises more than that God's done it to him, okay, recognises God's involved in it, how can a man who's suffering like that, who recognises God's done it to him, how can he possibly still be a man who trusts in God, still has faith in God? Is this a mighty achievement? Is Job one of the great heroes who, if only we had the resources in us that Job had in him, is that the sort of thing that Job is? Is he a model to us to try and emulate, to try and build up in ourselves the sort of strength of character and faith and godliness and all those things that Job had? Is he a hero and a model in that sense? No, he's not. What you see in Job is possible not because of what Job is like, but because of what God is like. How can Job, in his circumstances, rest his trust in God? How can you, in your circumstances, especially when things are going wrong, and you know that God's in it because he's in everything, how can you rest your trust in God? Not because of what you are like, and not because of what Job was like, but because of what God is like. Now, actually, I have no idea how Job got his knowledge of God. I don't know how he found out what God is like. We're just not told in the story. We don't know what lies behind the story in that regard. But he knew what God is like. I know how I know what God is like. And I know how you can know what God is like. We know because of Jesus. We know supremely because of what happened when Jesus Christ died on the cross for us. So when you think about that, when you hear about that, what you hear and what you learn and what you understand is that God loves us. Whatever else is true, whatever God is doing, whether we understand it or whether we don't, this is true. God loves you. The great display of that was Jesus dying for you on the cross. That's what God is like. God is good. And he's good towards us. And so no matter what happens to us, no matter what circumstances we're in, God can be trusted. What does trusting God mean? If it doesn't mean this, it means trusting God even when you don't understand what he's doing. Now we see the extreme of it here in the case of Job. Extreme circumstances, a man not knowing what God is doing and suffering at the hands of God. And yet because he knows what God is like, only that, not because he's extraordinarily pious and he's that kind of person, but he knows what God is like, he can continue to trust God. Now, all of our experiences, I don't care what you go through, I think it'll be less than this. And what I'm saying is, I'm not exhorting you to build yourself up and to be like Job, but I do want to exhort you to look at the God that Job knew. He's the God that we know, and he's the same. And he is so good that no matter where you are tonight, you can trust him because he loves you. And you can see that he loves you in the message about Jesus. Okay, how about we pray?